Juhayman and his followers put up a strong resistance to the extent that Saudi Arabia appealed to French special forces for help. The occupation of the sacred mosque came to an end after 14 days and following bloody clashes between the two sides. More than 100,000 Soviet armed forces invaded Afghanistan at midnight of December 27, 1979, to support the government formed by People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan. Two years into its formation, the Afghan government was engaged in a civil war following an uprising over its plans to change the social and religious structures of the country. Then U.S. President Jimmy Carter quickly issued a decree ordering a covert operation by the CIA to send arms to Afghan fighters from across the world. The Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, quickly appointed a team to provide all kinds of support to Afghan Mujahideen, and Pakistan was chosen as the nearest venue to organize, equip, and train them. Then Pakistani President Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq entered the operation in the hope of receiving military and financial assistance, as well as finding a strategic role in the region. Therefore, a mounting propaganda campaign against the Soviets' occupation of Afghanistan was launched across the world, especially in Islamic countries, to accelerate the process to recruit youths and dispatch them to Afghanistan. More than 35,000 people from 43 countries in the Middle East, North and East Asia, Central Asia, Far East and North Africa pledged allegiance to Afghan Mujahideen, and at least 20,000 of them went to Afghanistan to fight there. Among the young people who eagerly came to Afghanistan and Pakistan was a person named Osama bin Laden. He was from a prominent family that was highly influential due to its construction companies and close ties with the royal family in Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden met with Abdullah Azam, who was in charge of organizing migrant youths, and Osama was already acquainted with him in Saudi Arabia. After forming Bayt al-Ansar in 1984, that was one of the most important jihadi groups in Afghanistan, Osama, by 1986, established six more bases for the youth coming there from other countries to organize and direct them. Strikes by the Afghan groups against the invading forces were highly effective. The war, leaving heavy casualties, finally forced Soviet troops to leave Afghanistan. The last batch of them left the country on February the 15th, 1989. Meanwhile, a group that took a different path was Arab Afghans, those young people who had come to Afghanistan from across the world to help people there in the face of the occupation of their country. Since the majority of them were Arabs, they were called Arab Afghans. The rest decided to continue the path of fighting in different parts of the world. Their leader, Abdullah Azam, intended to transfer his forces to Palestine to continue jihad there after the occupation of Afghanistan ended. But Azam, along with his two sons, was killed in a suspicious bomb attack in Pakistan's city of Peshawar in 1989. It was in the early days of Osama's return to Saudi Arabia when everyone was shocked by an incident. Then Iraqi ruler Saddam Hussein invaded the country's small and rich neighbor Kuwait, advancing near the town of Al-Khafij on the border with Saudi Arabia. Osama, who had ties with the Saudi royal family, proposed that thousands of his forces be used for battles against Saddam to drive out the Ba'ath army from Kuwait. Osama believed that non-Muslim armies should not enter Islamic countries, especially Saudi Arabia, at a time when thousands of fresh fighters already defeating the invading Soviet army are able to fight Saddam's army. Saudi princes opposed Osama's proposal, probably because they were not hopeful that it would be practical, or they did not want him to turn into a national hero in this battle. A coalition led by the US was formed to drive out Saddam from Kuwait. Such a coalition had not previously been formed in any war. The opposition of Saudi officials to Osama bin Laden's plan angered him, and it was the beginning of a direct fight against the interests of the US and its Arab allies, including Saudi Arabia. That was because Osama considered Arab leaders as being completely controlled by the US, and he decided to target the US with his attacks. The beginning of the 1990s marked a new era for Osama and his followers as they felt that they had been betrayed by everyone and that they should find a new way. Attacking US interests in different parts of the world was top of the agenda of his organization called Al-Qaeda. The manpower required to do the job had been trained with the help of the US and Saudi Arabia years before and was present in all parts of the world following the Afghanistan war and was now ready to carry out the attacks. During these years, Osama lived in Sudan for a while, where he did business and carried out economic and development activities. Under pressure by Saudi Arabia, Osama returned to Afghanistan in 1996 with his former friends. At this time, the Taliban were in control of large parts of Afghanistan and were practically the undisputable ruler of the country. Finally, the September 11 arrived and the storm that the US had launched in Afghanistan years before returned home. According to the official account given by the George W. Bush administration, 19 people, 15 of them Saudi nationals, boarded U.S. Airlines passenger planes. In a few minutes, they hijacked the planes and attacked a number of key U.S. buildings, including the World Trade Center. Now, the talk of the town was Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden and the Taliban who had sheltered him in Afghanistan. The shock caused by the 9/11 attacks and the extensive media coverage of them was so high that prevented everyone, especially the Americans, from thinking about this question, that how was it possible for people in another part of the world, in a devastated country like Afghanistan, to plan such an operation and train individuals for it? In the days that followed the 9/11 attacks, several private jets were assigned with withdrawing a group of Saudi families from the U.S. They included 24 people from the Bin Laden family who were withdrawn without being investigated and left the U.S. to avoid being attacked by angry Americans. The U.S. asked the Taliban to hand over Osama. They rejected the request and the U.S. quickly prepared to invade Afghanistan. A war quickly began and Afghanistan was occupied again, this time by the U.S. New bombs were dropped on the ruins left from two decades of war. After the 9/11 attacks, a commission headed by Bob Graham was formed to launch an inquiry into U.S. intelligence community activities. The commission investigated the activities of the CIA and the FBI from February 2002 until December that year. It released an 832-page report on the inquiry, of which 28 pages were classified.
Former U.S. Senator Bob Graham has been trying to get the 28 pages released since the day they were classified back in 2003, when he played a major role in the first government investigation into 9/11.
Those 28 pages were about a foreign state's involvement in the 9/11 attacks and its financial and logistical help to the hijackers. That pits the families of the victims of the attacks, as well as many journalists and politicians, against the Bush administration. They voiced their objection to the classification of those 28 pages in the following years, but to no avail, and the pages remained in secrecy.
Proudly, deliberately using his full name, Barack Hussein Obama, he became the 44th president of the United States.
Finally, the tenure of President George W. Bush ended, and the new president entered the White House. Barack Obama, despite facing pressure to declassify the pages, also refused to do so, partly because of Saudi threats to sell $750 billion in U.S. assets.
Today, Congress gave families of 9/11 victims the right to sue Saudi Arabia on the theory.
Less than 5 months before the end of his presidency, the Obama administration published a full report on the congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks, although many parts of it were still covered in black. According to these 28 pages, two of the hijackers named Khalid al-Mizhar and Nawaf al-Hazmi had close ties with Osama Basnan and Omar al-Bayoumi. Basnan and al-Bayoumi had ties with the Saudi embassy and Ambassador Bandar bin Sultan, the key man in U.S.-Saudi relations, and they received salaries from Saudi company Dar al-Arkan without having a job there. The two hijackers, since their arrival in the U.S. until several weeks before the attacks, were provided with services by the group linked with the Saudi embassy. Another issue that the 28-page part of the report had raised was the transfer of money by Saudi charity organizations based in the U.S. and Europe to suspects of terrorist activities. The inquiry by the 9/11 Commission emphasized that Saudi Arabia had long funded the Al-Qaeda group through its wealthy citizens and charity organizations that enjoyed high financial support. Despite that, the inquiry concluded that there is no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior Saudi individuals funded Al-Qaeda. Maybe the best answer to this question has been given by Bandar bin Sultan, the former Saudi ambassador to the U.S.
We don't have taxes in the kingdom. People don't pay taxes. However, we have a religious tax that's dictated by our religion. And it is supposed to go to the poor. If you cannot find anybody needy, you go to the next neighborhood, or the next village, or the next city, or the next country. Well, in Saudi Arabia, God blessed us with a lot of wealth. We take care of almost all our people. So we send it to Afghanistan, to Bosnia, to Senegal, to anywhere in the world, to Africa, Asia, my point, the Arab world, but as charities.
But the reality was that those amounts of money were mostly used to build schools and mosques that spread the Wahhabi thinking in the world and led to the formation of groups such as Al-Qaeda and their new form, Daesh. The most controversial news in this regard came out while the U.S. was in the process of passing the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, known as JASTA. The bill passed the Senate and was aimed at allowing families of the 9/11 victims to sue the Saudi government and enabling them to ask for tens of billions of dollars in damage if their case went ahead. Controversy arose after the New York Times revealed that quote-unquote senior White House officials had contacted members of Congress demanding that they reject JASTA. The officials had cited threats by Saudi Arabia to sell $750 billion in assets in case that law is implemented.
On Wednesday, Congress overwhelmingly voted to override President Barack Obama's veto of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, also known as JASTA, which would allow Americans to potentially sue Saudi Arabia for the 9/11 attacks.
U.S. District Judge George Daniels in Manhattan, who rejected the lawsuit filed by the families of the 9/11 victims, said Saudi Arabia had sovereign immunity from damage claims by them. The status means that sovereign governments are immune from lawsuits in U.S. courts. Despite all the indications, Judge Daniels issued a weird ruling on May the 1st of 2018.
A federal judge is ordering Iran to pay billions of dollars to the families of the victims of the attacks of 9/11.
Iran should pay $10.5 billion in damage to the families of the 9/11 victims and several insurers over what the U.S. federal judge called its role in the attacks. That ruling was not taken seriously even in the U.S. Maybe Saudi officials' direct link with the 9/11 attacks cannot be exactly found, and perhaps it's basically wrong to find such a link in a 28-page report and its covered lines. The reality of this story is the whole history of Saudi Arabia, where people in schools have been taught hatred for more than 100 years now.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Imam Ali, alayhi salatu wasalam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Muhammad. He says that you are to live for this world as if you are to live for 100 years. At the same time, he says, live for the akhirat and the hereafter as if you were to die tomorrow. What does that mean? That means plan. Plan. Save your money, plan for the future, invest in a house. Look 20 years, 30 years down the road. Right? To those who are part of the Jamaat, let's say, for example, and you are the decision makers of that Jamaat. A lot of your discussions and your decisions, be it based on the fact that you invite someone like me to speak, or be it the fact that, you know, you may one day decide to move buildings, let's say, for example, all of that is with 15, 20 years in mind. In our personal life, same idea. We get married, we think to ourselves, okay, you know what? I'm going to have children, raise those kids, marry those kids off, become a grandparent. All those things are. At the same time, we are not to attach ourselves to this world such that if we are to leave tomorrow, we are ready to go tomorrow for the hereafter. Very balanced. Imam Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam, says that if you are to measure the level of khawf and rija, of fear and hope inside of the believer's heart, they will weigh the exact same amount. One of my favorite hadiths, I tell you. There are those people who are so hopeful, they are delusional. They continue to justify every sin that they make, no sort of presence of them trying to cleanse themselves, clear themselves up, you know, avoid that sin. No, let's keep going, let's have God forgive me. He promised He'll forgive me, I'll keep giving Him every reason to forgive me. That's delusion. There's no way that God can forgive me. My sins are too big. His mercy won't cover my sins. Blah, blah, blah. You have no idea what I've done. Both of them are extremes. Both of them are to be rejected. Imam Sadiq says, if you are to measure both of them, you are to find the exact same amount. A believer lives on hope. A believer lives on fear as well. There are several others like that. In this discussion on the world of emotional intelligence, the maktab of the Ahlul Bayt, the school of thought of the Shias, also have asked the human being to find a moderate level of emotion. Be it your desire or be it your anger. Let's give some examples. What do I mean by this? Let's start off with those who have a deficient level of anger. Because what I want to change tonight is I want to change this perception we have of anger to be somebody punching through a wall, to be somebody just tearing somebody apart with their words, to be somebody, God forbid, physically abusing somebody, to somebody committing a crime, hurting themselves out of rage and anger, right? That's not always the picture of anger. Sometimes anger actually breeds beautiful qualities inside of the human being. That's revered and respected by God. I'll get to that in a moment. Follow me. So there are levels of a deficiency of anger that irritates God. When a person doesn't have enough anger, they become a coward. Follow me for a moment. What is it that stops somebody from defending their family? Or let's go another route. What factor, what emotion is it that allows somebody to find find the courage to stand up, let's say, to a bully, or stand up, let's say. Let's say, for example, you're coming home after a program at the Jamaat, and you're on your way home, and you pull into your driveway, and God forbid, you see somebody who is inside of your home, now robbing your home right in front of your eyes. The front door is busted open, you look inside, and this guy is in the kitchen, just filling up his sack with all of your dishes and everything. What do you do? First of all, the first anger is rage, angry. Along with, you know, you're in shock, maybe you're a little bit scared, he might have a weapon. But the anger now will force you to say, excuse me, what are you doing in my house? Get out of my house right now. If you have the right amount of anger. And you become the defender of the home, the defender of your property, the defender of your family. But if you have a deficient level of anger, that cowardice comes in and you run. There are some people who run and leave their family right in the middle of the danger. Right? There's a fire going on inside the house and they knock everyone else down. They go straight out for the front door. Meanwhile, the wife is on the ground and the kids are on the ground inhaling smoke. But hey, you're on the front lawn and you're safe. There are people like that in this world. That cowardice is not something revered by God. There's nothing Islamic about that. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu qu anfusikum wa ahlikum nara. O you who believe, protect yourself and your family from the fire. You have that duty, especially as husbands and men in the audience. You are the qawameen. You are the maintainers, the protectors of the household. Doesn't mean that everyone else is too weak. Oh, come and protect me. Oh, my savior. No. Allah is telling the man that you are responsible for that. Now, if the man doesn't have a certain level of anger inside of them, in terms of a level where now, when they see someone disrespecting their wife, or disrespecting their kids, or their home, or themselves, that anger breeds what? That anger now breeds courage. It's a very noble trait. So when you are deficient in anger, you become a coward. And then you become a mazloom. A Muslim in the most negative sense. That now you are the object of everyone else's oppression. You don't stand up for yourself. Someone sits there, talks smack about your wife in front of you. You don't say a word. Why? Because you're scared of them. A man now, disrespecting your wife in front of you. You don't say a single word. Why? Because he's 6'8", 6'4", got huge forearms. Doesn't matter. Let him bruise you up. Let him break your legs. But you don't let him talk to your wife like that. A deficient level of anger causes a man who should stay there and fight to actually do what? Flight and take off. It's not revered in Islam. It's not respected in Islam. Imam Hussein stood there, 30,000 people on one side, 120 some say on one side. He knew it's going to be one-sided. Forget one-sided. He will be killed in the most brutalist ways. His submission to God, his anger for the enemies of Allah, all caused him now to be there on the day of Ashura, facing the enemy. So there can be a deficient level of anger, absolutely. There can also be an excessive amount of anger as well. When now, of course, you just snap. Where you should be quiet and freeze, or you should walk away respectfully, you don't. You stay and you fight. And there are some people who, when they get angry, everything is out of control. Their tongue goes, their limbs go. They say things that they never thought they would say. They become people that other people are scared about, their own family tipping toes around them, right? One little word snap, one little event snap, right? And they just, they cause, a very difficult life inside the house for everyone around them. So there's expression there of anger for sure, but there's an excessive amount of expression where Allah says, speak to your children in a loving tone. Speak to your spouse in a soft, naram lahja, as you say. Right? Address the mu'mineen with loving terms. Even talk to your enemy with respect. But here you are, obscene language, insults that really, really dig deep. Right? Snapping at your children to the point where now you say words that echo in their minds 20 years afterwards. Stripping them of their dignity. Telling them you amount to nothing, I wish I never had you, what kind of child do I have, you're worthless, you're useless. All these things, out of anger now, I'm sorry I was angry, you said sorry, no problem. But those words echo in their mind, And later on now, they'll begin to rear their ugly heads. That's an excessive amount of anger. There are people I know, I'm sure all of you do too, unless they punch something, their anger can't, you know, it won't get out. So you see holes all over their walls, their drywall in the house. Very common. That's excessive. Those are people who need therapy, anger management therapy. There's no way Islam condones that. And that brings me to the moderate level of anger, which I'm sure now you picked up. That moderate level of anger, if the deficient level is cowardice, if the excessive element is an animal like behavior, that moderate level that we're all trying to aspire to is courage.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمني صل عليه.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady. You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, I have the honor of being joined by Sister Salma Khalfan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. I'm pretty sure we've discussed this before, either on this segment or some other shows, but you can never talk about it enough, really. An Islamic lifestyle, one that a woman can implement into her everyday life, into her routine, and that would bring her a sense of satisfaction, a sense of satiation, you know, that she'd feel fulfilled in her life. I think that's so important because at the end of the day, what are we trying to do except find meaning in life?
We want to feel that we are living for a purpose.
Yes.
Otherwise, you see that sometimes, you know, shaitan comes in our mind and we feel that, why did we come to this world in the mm-hmm. first place? But if you have a purpose and a goal, we'll always look at the end, the goal. That no, I want Allah to be happy with me. I want to prosper because Allah has kept a place for me in Jannah. He wants me to live there forever.
Beautiful.
This world is just like a bridge to pass. We have to collect the good deeds and go there in the long run. So it doesn't mean that, you know, we have to be miserable in this world. Plus Allah says that even treat your nafs, part of your day should go in giving those treats to yourself to feel happy about it, you know. Because we are so much attached to this nature, our body is inclined to, you know, this kind of nature that is outside, eating, drinking, getting happy, friends, social life. Allah said, no, it's halal, enjoy. But don't spend your time,
it's
everything in that. And have a rule to have an aim behind these things.
Yeah, it's not your objective.
Yes, only we have to be alert.
Yeah.
The point is to be alert that why are you doing this? Alert in all matters, the worldly and the hereafterly. Otherwise, sometimes the worldly matters, if you're alert, you earn so much sawabs, more than the hereafterly, where you don't practice that being alert. You're just doing it out of habituation.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So everything requires that alertness. Now here, a woman has, of course, again, a very great, big, beautiful role to play at home, and how to make a lifestyle like a preparation ground for the betterment of the society.
Mm-hmm.
First, when she gets married. And that's between the spouses, how she acts with her spouse. So there are two things that are very important when the man and the woman enjoy this right.
Mm-hmm.
A woman has the right to be loved and to be taken care of. A man has the right to be respected. So these two things are like two pillars to give rise to a generation who have love in their hearts and who have respect for the people to make, you know, like everything go swiftly in every way, among their children, with the people, in the society, you know, your relationships with people, how you want the betterment for the people, how you want their progress. All of it revolves around love and respect. And those are the lessons you yourself practice with your husband first.
Beautiful.
So you deserve that love. It's very important for a man to even express his love. And Hadith
verbally
says that when you do express this love, it does never come out from her heart.
Mm.
It's the way she is, you know. She appreciates that. And halid deen illal hub. Deen is all about love. If you go and see, we have the master character in us to want to express love and to feel loved. And then there's another side of it. A man, he needs that respect. He needs to be shown that respect. He's the authoritative one. He's the authority of the house. So with these two things, you're building a very good society. And a man and woman should compete in this. You know, like who is giving more love and who is giving more respect. So it's very important. As-sabiqoon, as-sabiqoon, ulaika al-muqarrabun. And that's preparing for the zuhur of Imam Zamana. He wants the muqarrabin to be the leaders, right? The 313. And then when this comes about and you see strong relationships like this giving rise to offsprings that are so like, mashallah, they are so successful at home, in their akhlaq, with their respect towards their parents, and outside also, they are so like successful in every way. People love them because of their good akhlaq. They show respect to people and they move forward. The society loves them. So respect and love is fused in them. Through what? That society that is built in the smallest unit of the home. Mm. And that's what? Spreading the Islamic lifestyle.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, sisters, brothers, ladies, gentlemen. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio.
When we are bringing up children, the best miras and inheritance you can leave is the good manners.
Absolutely.
Adab is the best miras to give the children. It's good because they have a sense of confidence in them also. When people respect them around them, that what a mashallah, respectful person, this, what a kind person, what a loving person, they gain that self-confidence that I'm appreciated. So it moves on. And then another thing that is so important, that is Islamic lifestyle, is being organized at home. Nazm. Right. You know, Imam Ali alayhi salam in his deathbed said, Nazm
fi umurikum.
Al-Quran, Nazm fi umurikum, right? That means in all the matters, organization is very important. And Allah, alhamdulillah, has given us such a beautiful timetable, our 5 daily prayer. That starts off with nazm, you know. And
absolutely.
Such a nazm that we have to be aware of all the timings in the right ways and also prepare that we are, you know, like when we are praying, we are conversing with Allah. So if we sit around, then we have not prayed the proper prayer. And in fact, the prayer's outlet is that it makes you stronger in faith also. It makes you more fearful. It makes you more alert. It makes you more, aware of what you're doing, because you don't want that prayer to be wasted. Okay? Having a timetable for yourself, that is the spiritual timetable, and that when you do have, you'll see that you'll have an organized timetable for your children as well. That, you know, your children, how... It's naturally the mother to see the timetable of a child. It's very important also when the baby is born that the mother keeps the timetable of the child, that, you know, it's so and so times this child will need to be fed, to be nursed. And so time this child has a nap. And so time this child needs to play. So it's so natural to love that organization, you know. Yeah, the routine should be used so beautifully that you feel a sense of achievement at the end of the day. But everything goes wrong and you don't know, okay, so my baby, why is he crying? Okay, maybe he's this, maybe he's that. You don't feed him properly, or you go out at that time and leave it to the husband, or you find a nurse, you know, to take care of the child. You'll see everything going so wrong, you know, in the life of a child. So it starts with when a mother has this child whom she loves so much, whom she has the natural inclination to get a timetable for. So Allah loves us more than that. He wants us to also develop this timetable, the spiritual and physical timetable.
Yeah, because we need stability.
Yes.
That's one of the most fundamental things a child needs during the early stages of their lives. And we all started at that point as children. And we need stability. We need something that we can depend on in terms of it creating a structure for our lives. And only through that can we have the, like you said, the confidence and the inner peace to navigate through life. Yeah. You take that away from a child because you don't know how to parent right, or because you can't even stick to your religious routines and schedules. And not only did you ruin your akhirah, you ruined this child's dunya as well.
And then you see such children, they're complaining of boredom.
Yes.
And I'm bored.
Yes,
I'm bored. So, you know, like... I usually use this method that, you know, when before they even have the chance to say that we are bored, like the night before you tell them, tomorrow we have a very long day. We're going to do this, we're going to do that,
yes.
We're going to do this and that. So we have 4 things in our agenda and they're all useful. So it's like you look forward
they're
to
They're already
it.
Looking forward
yeah, they're
to
all,
it.
Yes. They don't have time to be bored, you
exactly.
see.
Exactly.
So like if we want to read... The next day, we'll say that we have a class tomorrow and then we're going to read this book and then you're going to play for a while and then again we're going to go, for example, out for a while and then we're going to go to the mosque and when we come back, we'll be so tired that we're going to sleep.
Exactly.
So it's like a whole timetable being built and it's so important. I remember that when I was young, I used to complain of boredom a lot. And I used to feel that I don't know what to do with my time. And just the idle mind is the devil's workshop, you see.
Totally.
So it's so important to to not repeat this mistake. And I felt that, why am I bored? When there's so many things to do, I have so many books to read. But I guess, you know, with, like sometimes the surroundings around you, so many kids around you, somehow lack of knowledge, your parents don't know the very right thing to do at that time. Maybe overwhelmed with the situation, maybe no helper around them. So it's not their fault. But now we could do a favor for them to bring their generation, give the generation quality.
Yep.
Right? So we want to give their generation quality by realizing all these things and making it better for them, the kids. So it's very important to have the nazm always. Nazm fi umurikum, yes. In our lives. In the lives of our weekly duties also, preparing a timetable for cooking so that you don't have an excuse to say, what do I cook? Always have a timetable that, for example, a general timetable, I'm going to have meat twice a day. I'm going to cook meat twice a day. Or sometimes I'm going to cook for 2 days. I'm going to cook in such a way with the consent of the people around you that I'm going to eat for 2 days. It's okay because I'm busy, right? And you have the permission.
Have a plan.
Yeah,
Have a plan.
I need to do some reading. Yeah. So when you do have a plan, you go so swiftly and you feel time is so much barkat, so much like blessings that you can do so many things during a day, and you feel so blessed, you feel so happy,
so fulfilled.
Yeah, so fulfilled.
Young people who are struggling with which direction to take in life, they go to a counselor or a therapist or whatever. The first thing that person would say is that have a routine, have a schedule, wake up and go to bed at a certain time.
Yeah.
Start somewhere.
At least know what you're going to do during the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Something fruitful, something that would give you pleasure, happiness, that's the right thing, that would make you grow in perfection, that you would feel useful. That you're doing something that makes you happy. Inshallah, that we use ourselves, our time in the appropriate manner and not waste the time. It's so much stressed in Quran, by the time Allah swears. Why this time? Because it's our capital, our asset. That every time we, like even now, moment by moment, I'm getting closer to my death.
Mm.
So it's inevitable that it's going. But if I'm compensating it with good deeds, then I get a better capital. That capital that is lost. Allah wants a better capital for you.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely
through these things that you use your time in the, with ibadah, wal isale, calling people towards truth, calling people towards sabr, and enjoining, people towards patience and things like that. So, inshallah, with all this, Islam is replete with so many good things for us, so many teachings through ahadith, Quran. We just have to open our hearts, as I time and again say, towards these things, and we'll see that we are moving forward, having a beautiful life and having that qana'at, that feeling of satisfaction that we were born for the right purpose. Otherwise, it's like sometimes you feel that, why am I doing this?
Why do I bother even?
Yeah, why do I bother?
Oh,
and then you waste yourself
feeling.
and you feel so left out. And if you keep on, it brings so much hopelessness now within you, which is gunai kabira. And then it takes you towards, God forbid, a person may feel that it's better.
So many
suicidal thoughts,
that people are having sadly in the world is because they're thinking, why do I bother?
Yeah.
What's the meaning of any of this? And I'm not saying that, just fix your iman and everything's going to be all right. It comes with knowledge. It comes with practice, with patience, with help and support.
Iman.
Yes. And all of that is so very important. And we are so out of time. Thank you so very much, Sister Salma, for your insight. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Until another episode, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
I know I'm waiting. Waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Hidden Files.
Well, for us Americans, the U.S. invasion of Iraq was set like an elaborate game. U.S. forces were to bravely buckle up and eliminate the enemies of democracy in Iraq. Propaganda was pouring in from all sides about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and more. And Americans were encouraged to cheer on the forces as we joined them in spirit, thousands of miles away in nearly everything we did, even in the games we played, games such as the Iraqi Most Wanted card game, which was promoted back then in 2003. Well, these cards were officially named personality identification playing cards and had on them the pictures of the Iraqi regime officials that the U.S. military was aiming to heroically eliminate. And by the way, these figures include some whom had formerly been put in place and supported by the U.S., but that's a story for another day. Of course, as those of us familiar with politics and propaganda could already predict years later, it was discovered that not only was Iraq void of WMDs, but in reality, it was the American forces which were a threat to Iraqis, not the other way around. Then we read about secret American prisons and all kinds of unbelievable torture methods. And so, as a result of these crimes, a person continues to serve time in prison. Strangely enough, that person is not any of those who initiated the offensive on Iraq. Instead, he's the man behind exposing American crimes in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo Bay, a whistleblower called Julian Assange. Welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marcia Hashimi. And now let's take a look at what this is really all about and who is Julian Assange.
Julian Assange is a 51-year-old journalist from Australia, a computer expert and publisher who wanted to give access to whistleblowers to share their information. In December 2006, he publishes the first WikiLeaks cable on the site. On April 5, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the collateral damage of Iraq. In July 2010, the Afghanistan papers. In August 2010, Sweden files a sexual misconduct case against Assange. On October 22, 2010, WikiLeaks releases the Iraq war logs, documenting the U.S. invasion and occupation of the country. On June 19, 2012, Assange enters the Ecuadorian embassy in London to avoid arrest. In August 2012, Ecuador grants him citizenship based on political asylum, but the UK will arrest him if he leaves the embassy to travel to Ecuador. In May 2017, Sweden drops the charges. On April 11, 2019, he is forcibly removed from the embassy and sent to the high-security Belmarsh prison in the UK, where he has been since. On May 23, 2019, the U.S. charges Assange with 17 counts of espionage. In total, Assange has 18 charges against him in the U.S. and could face 175 years in prison. Currently, Assange is still fighting extradition to the United States. In total, Assange spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London and now has spent 3 years in Belmarsh prison.
Only in WikiLeaks' release of Iraq war documents, 391,832 United States Army field reports were exposed. Now, these Iraq war logs were from 2004 to 2009 and published on the internet on October the 22nd, 2010. Well, the files record 66,081 civilian deaths out of 109,000 recorded deaths. Now, this means over 60% of the deaths, I repeat, 60% of the deaths recorded were civilians. Well, one would think that after the publishing of these documents, some of those responsible for such war crimes would be held accountable, perhaps made to pay a fine to the families of the victims or sentenced to time in prison. Unfortunately, the reality could be nothing further from the truth. And even one of the leaders of that fabricated Western war against Iraq, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, is even said to be knighted by the Queen. So in this world where values seem to be upside down, wouldn't you know it, that it is Assange, the whistleblower, who ended up being investigated, tracked down, and incarcerated. Assange is paying the price for exposing the crimes, but the criminals who committed the crimes continue to walk free and in some instances are hailed as heroes. And Assange is facing possible extradition to the United States and a 175 years prison sentence, if that's possible. Well, stay with us as we look a little closer at all of this with our first guest.
Dr. Deepa Govindarajan Driver. She has served 3 years as a legal observer in the case of Julian Assange. She is a trade unionist and is interested in state and corporate accountability, as well as the protection of whistleblowers. Dr. Driver teaches governance, compliance, risk management, and regulation.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Driver. Now, you have been an observer for more than 3 years at the Julian Assange trial. Why have you been in court during that time?
Thanks for asking the question. About 3.5 years ago, I started to monitor this case on behalf of the and through the process on behalf of the Haldane Society of Socialist Lawyers and the ALDH. Because I think this case is really important for ordinary people, people like you and me and people in your audience, who want to know, who want to understand what's happening behind closed doors. As an academic, I study whistleblowing and governance. And whether it's a care home where an elderly relative is being mistreated, or whether it's a prison where somebody's being harmed, or whether it's climate justice and dumping toxic waste, or whether it is war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. The only way we know about what really happens behind closed doors is through the courage of whistleblowers.
Well, what message do you think the U.S. is trying to give to journalists and others with the Assange case?
It was very, very courageous in the way it stood up to the world's greatest superpower, that is America, when they said, you know, you have all this evidence. It is accurate. Nobody was able to challenge its accuracy, whether it was torture at Guantanamo or war crimes in Iraq or the Americans putting pressure on the Germans not to allow Khaled El-Masri's case to come to trial. You know, he was this German citizen who was rendited, sodomized, tortured. And then they found it was a case of mistaken identity. So this kind of information only came into the public domain in a way in which the Americans couldn't deny it, thanks to WikiLeaks. And then you have the situation where the Americans then said to WikiLeaks, hang on a second, you're not allowed to share this because it shows our criminality and the criminality of our allies. Firstly, Assange is not a U.S. citizen. He didn't carry out any of his journalism in the U.S. either. He's a non-union citizen carrying out serious journalism about U.S. war crimes abroad. And the U.S. is trying to use the Espionage Act, which is an act that was created in 1917, I believe, or thereabouts, and which is highly contested, which is not seen as a very benign act, especially now. And its use against a journalist is deeply troubling because, you know, to classify journalism as espionage is deeply worrying. But what is also worrying is the fact that instead of the people who tortured the 789 Muslim men in Guantanamo being on trial, we now have Julian Assange being silenced in Belmar. And that sends a message to journalists. It says, tomorrow, if you were to receive a whistleblower telling you, here's another Guantanamo happening, and you're not a journalist in the US, you're somewhere else in the world, will you disclose those war crimes, knowing that the United States has extradition treaties with various countries? So this is not going to, a lot of people say, oh, this is going to set a chilling precedent for journalism with Julian's extradited. But the chilling precedent has already been set. Nobody, no journalist, is safe now. And we need to stop this right now.
Yeah, indeed. It's so troubling. Dr. Driver, I want to look at Britain's role in all of this because, as you know, the Home Secretary has recently given the okay for Assange to be extradited. Your take on that side of things?
Well, you're absolutely right. You know,